Ozymandias am I. If any would know how great am I and where I lie, let him surpass but one work of mine. Aedetis aedinae, buletae, pelekos emi, taipu kemai, nicato titon emon egon. From Fallen Colossus of Pharaoh Rameses II, and inspiration for Shelley's poem Ozymandias, Diodorus Siculus, Chapter 1, verse 47, 1st century BCE. Part 1. Babylon. Chapter 1. Hunter. The reeds of the Nile Delta rustled in the wind, the afternoon heat hanging in the glimmering distance, a rippling lake of molten silver floating above sharp sands. Stark and bright against the green of the waving grasses, a crane picked its way delicately through the shallows, raising one thin leg slowly, then placing it with care, waiting, motionless. The world seemed to have awoken unscathed from a terrible dream of thunder and cannon, of ships and fire, and now lay quiet, a picture of peace, unaware of the works of man, knowing only the sun and the wind, whose breezes shivered the surface of the cooling floodwaters. Far in the distance, to the east, the town of Kafa Shahabas baked silently at the edge of the mirage, its walls glowing white in the glare. Just beyond the outskirts, two local fellahin farmers in long, threadbare galabea smocks sweated up a steep bank to the dusty road. Between them they hefted a heavy sack of meal up the slope from a flat-bottomed punt in the reeds. After only a few paces, they staggered and stopped, the man behind losing his grip and dropping his end of the sack, cursing at the other. Then both stood still, staring along the road to the west in the direction of Rosetta. One of them pointed, the other peered more carefully, then backed away, his voice rising in panic. Alarmed, a flock of sacred ibis took flight. Immediately the horizon was alive with spray and flashing wings of black and white, the birds' shrieking calls filling the air, the startled crane joining them, the water sheeting off its plumes as it flapped into the sky. Shouting to each other, the two men tried to snatch up the sack, its weight too great for their haste, dragging it a few yards before abandoning it, running to the town's gatehouse, waving their arms, calling out. Figures appeared in the arched gateway of the curtain wall, some with muskets, looking along the main road, then ducking back inside, waving the fellahin into safety. Far off among the marshes and flooded islands of reed, unseen by the people of Kafa Shahabas, a hand rose up, two fingers pointing to the left, then sank out of sight. Lying on the muddy banks of grass and stubble, Marine Sergeant Jory Cook's narrowed gaze flicked in the direction of the signal. They all heard the noise, the dull thump of hooves, the clicking of buckles and tack. Horses. The French had come.
"God save Bristol," he muttered. "There they are."
Half submerged, next to him, William John Hazard, Captain of Marines, stared through an eyeglass.
"Move them closer."
Cook looked to Marine Private Warnock on his right and Corporal Pettifer on his left. Like Hazard and Cook, they lay in the water and mud, hidden by clumps of reed, partly in marine scarlet and partly in Bedouin garb, dark kefaya headdresses for the sun and binnish robes. Warnock clutched a feathered native tomahawk from the Americas in one hand. "Huron," he had said once. Pettifer, a giant, wide-mouthed Royal Navy musketoon blunderbuss. They were old hands from long before the Battle of the Nile, and what they had now called the Malta Chase, Nelson's dash across the Mediterranean to catch Napoleon Bonaparte's invasion fleet. These marines had done it without Nelson or anyone else and had engaged the enemy in the invasion of Malta on their own. Cook glanced at Pettifer and saw the big Cornishman's frown.
"Veteran blockade duty, innit?" said Cook.
"Aye, Sarge."
Pettifer glanced over his shoulder at Tariq, their Huaytat scout, who gave a brief whistle. Behind them, 10 Bedou of the Beni Qasim rose up silently from the knee-deep water and darted across the terrain among the tall grasses, stopping, sinking down.